Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
There were three ravens sat on a tree. Down a down, hey, down a down. They were as black as they might be with a down. One of them said to his mate, where shall we our breakfast take? With a down, dairy, 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 down, down.
Welcome to the Three Ravens podcast. Rest your aching legs, weary traveller. Lay down your load, gather close around our campfire and listen in. I'm Eleanor Conlon, and I'm flying on dragon back to survey the lands below. But luckily, my co-host Martin Vaux is right behind me with the map.
Hello! I can confirm that dragons are just as directionally challenged as we are.
In today's episode, we're returning to Somerset, where cheese and cider are as plentiful as apple trees. I'll be introducing my first witch of the new season with my telling of the Witch of Wookie Hole, dancing with the devil at a wedding feast, and discovering why you should never let a king in a kitchen.
This is our second trip around the history and folklore of England's 39 historic counties. And as we mentioned on the last episode, we're swapping over this time. So it's Eleanor's turn to explore Somerset, where I was born.
But before we whip up the horses and roll the cart across the Mendip Hills to Cheddar Gorge, we have some wonderful new Patreons to thank. Holly, Louise and Mary, and also a shout out to Elaine, who became even more kingly by joining the higher tier. All hail Holly, King of Patreon.
All hail Louise, King of Patreon.
All hail Mary, King of Patreon.
All hail Elaine, even more kingly king of Patreon.
If you'd also like to find out what extra good things we have available to our Patreon subscribers, come over to patreon.com/threeravenspodcast and open a box of delights. We've got exclusive episodes, our monthly newsletter with folk customs, tarot spreads, spells and more, episodes of the Three Ravens Film Club, and all this could be yours for just $3 a month or $6 a month. So please do have a look.
Yes, plus ad-free listening. Anyway, you can interact with us on social media as well at facebook.com/threeravenspodcast, Instagram at @threeravenspodcast, and on X at @threeravenspod. And you can chat with each other on our lovely Three Ravens podcast group on Facebook too, where listeners are always posting intriguing things, as we will talk about later.
If you'd like to get in touch with us in the longer form, you can also send us an email at threeravenspodcast@gmail.com, which is the place to send thoughts, pictures, close encounters with the Fae, your theories on the exact timeline of King Arthur's return, anything.
Yep, that email address is also the place to send your entries to our next writing competition. We so enjoyed our last one that we've decided to hold another with a spooky theme for this year's haunting season. We've extended the word count to 3,000 words. As we know, 1,000 was a bit short. So if you've got stories of ghosties, ghoulies, long-legged beasties, or things that go bump in the night, we want to hear it.
And now I think that's quite enough housekeeping. Mm-hmm. We're releasing this episode on Monday the 29th of April, which is St. Endelion, or Endelienta's Day.
Oh, gosh. I don't know how we've done this, but I feel I've somehow managed it so that I have an unfair proportion of episode releases on nothing days. Well, you always seem to end up with obscure saints.
I am very drawn to obscure saints, so I'm delighted.
Okay, so who exactly was Saint Endelion? I actually think we should start a scoring system for saints of yore with points in various categories. For example, horrific martyrdom, miracles, relics, themed snacks, and also merchandise.
I love that idea, and I will work on it for next time, assuming I don't draw a nothing day.
Yep.
So Saint Endelion was a 6th century daughter of the Welsh king Brychan, who travelled to North Cornwall on a mission of Christian conversion, as was so often the way. She's also supposedly one of King Arthur's goddaughters.
I didn't know that King Arthur was anybody's godparent.
Well, he must have quite liked Endelion, as he actually plays a part in her story.
Really?
So she relocated to Cornwall with some of her siblings and stayed in various places, including with St. Necton, who happened to be her brother. Then she eventually settled at a place called Trentinny, where she became a hermit and only consumed the milk of a local cow and the water from a nearby well.
Wow, okay.
Her sister, and this should actually be called the tale of the saintly siblings, because her sister was a saint as well, St. Dillick.
Well, we've come across that before, haven't we? Yeah, two
saintly
saint
family.
Sisters, yeah.
She'd also settled close by, and they'd often meet up at a particular point between where they both lived. But after their meetings, the grass was said to grow greener in that place than anywhere else.
Well, so far, so incredibly wholesome. And you wonder if that's got anything to do with, you know, the fact that she'd just been drinking milk and water and then maybe had made the grass greener, you know, after meeting with us. I don't know. Anyway, so what went wrong with this woman so that she became a saint?
So suspicious. Maybe nothing went wrong. And Endelion and her saintly siblings just had a nice quiet life.
Don't believe it. What happened?
No, something did go wrong.
Yeah, I knew it.
Unfortunately, Endelion's cow and her sole source of nutrition was killed by the Lord of Trentinny when it accidentally wandered onto his land, because cows can't read keep out signs.
No.
And the next part is why I say that King Arthur was a more than usually attentive godparent to Endelion, because he actually killed the Lord for callously murdering her cow.
I've got to say, that is quite an extreme reaction from the once and future king there.
Indeed. So much so that Endelion actually felt bad about it and did some holy necromancy to bring the Lord back to life.
Hold on. Holy necromancy? What?
Brought him back to life. Because she felt a bit guilty. Thought it was a bit extreme of King Arthur.
But bringing people back from the dead is normally not considered to be a terribly holy thing to do, is it?
Hush, Martin. Okay, anyway, history doesn't show if she told Arthur that she'd done this.
No.
After that, it seems she lived in relative quiet. So that was kind of it. Until she had a vision of her death and requested that her body be carried on a cart drawn by bullocks and buried where the bullocks stopped.
Okay, I mean, that's peculiar. But I'm going to say, she must have found another cow. She can't have lived on just water for the rest of her days.
No, I think she found another cow. But one wonders if she had the power of holy necromancy.
Oh, yeah.
Assume the Lord must have cooked her original cow.
Undead milkshakes, maybe, though.
Ooh, maybe also that was a bit possibility. Too rock and roll for St. Endelion. Not sure.
Anyway, it feels like a valid way of choosing a grave site. These bullocks will drag me, and where they stop, that's the place.
Although, not great if the bullocks drag you onto private land, for example, or like through someone's French windows.
Well, as you've said, they don't read signs. They pay no heed.
No. Well, anyway, 29th of April was actually her death day.
Was it a horrific death?
The description of Endelion's death is one of those delightfully non-specific pieces of folklore.
Go on.
She's simply supposed to have been killed by pirates.
Whoa.
But there's no details at all about this.
The pirates? What?
I know. Anyway, the bullock ceremony was enacted, Endelion was buried on top of a hill, and a church was built on top. And the present church of St. Endelion is still on that site today, and they hold a lovely music festival there each year.
Well, a happy Saint's Day to Endelion, King Arthur's goddaughter, cow enthusiast, necromancer, and tragic victim
of pirates.
Alas. 29th of April is also, according to the early English calendars, though I'm not really sure why they thought this information was useful to have, the day that Noah left the ark, having entered it with his many animal friends 2 weeks previous on the 17th of April.
I love that it was that quick a turnaround.
Yeah. 2 weeks of the Great Flood and out we go.
Whole world flooded, but only for 2 weeks.
Yep.
I mean, I suppose if you lived in fear that another Great Flood might one day come, knowing its exact duration might help you with a bit of forward disaster planning. Exactly how much food do you need to pack for two giraffes for 2 weeks?
I mean, those are the big questions, yeah, aren't they? And obviously the ones that the almanac writers of yore felt needed to be covered.
Of course, this week we've also got Walpurgisnacht, or May Day Eve, and May Day or Beltane. So there's plenty to celebrate. We will certainly be wearing our flower crowns and dancing around our tiny fire. But we'd love to hear from you if you are celebrating too. Do you have any Beltane traditions? Or perhaps you've attended a traditional maypole dance or a Jack in the Green festival? Tell us about it on social media or send us an email to 3ravenspodcast@gmail.com.
Martin, could you help me with the county criers? They look as though they've got designs on that poor unsuspecting cow.
Come here.
Come on, you lot. Ring us into Somerset.
Hear ye, hear ye. Hear ye.
Gather round.
Oh,
yeah.
Gather round.
Gather round.
Gather round.
Somerset is located in the southwest of England. It's bordered by the Bristol Channel, Bristol and Gloucestershire to the north, Wiltshire to the east, Dorset to the southeast, and Devon to the southwest. As ever, there's a map showing its precise location in England on the blog at 3ravenspodcast.com, which has a brand spanking new plumage and is looking very fancy now, so please do go and have a look.
I had a big overhaul of the website. It's a lot more colourful and is a lot prettier. There's a lot more on it now.
You've done a great job. It looks really beautiful, so go and check it out. Now, new for Series 4, we're thrilled to present our brand new Local Legends series. The basic idea is that each week we'll interview a folklore expert about their home county and include parts of our conversation in the episode, as well as releasing the entire interview on Saturday. For this week's episode, we had the pleasure of interviewing the fairy folk.
Now, to clarify, we didn't interview an entire court of fairies, but I did enjoy a conversation with the host of the Fairy Folk podcast, a wholesome travel, folklore and storytelling podcast which takes listeners on an eclectic journey around the myth and magic of the United Kingdom.
We asked the fairy folk about her experience of growing up in Somerset.
Yes. You and I are both from Somerset. We're both from the county.
Yes.
What was it like growing up for you in Somerset? How would you describe it to an outsider?
Well, yeah, lots of lovely countryside and fields, I think, was something that I absolutely loved growing up. There was always beautiful countryside to get lost in, places to visit. I was really lucky in where I lived that it was very close by to villages. So I was able to explore those and, yeah, visit the parks. It's a very leafy kind of green upbringing, which I absolutely love. I really love being close to nature. So that's something that's really important to me. So, yeah, there was a lot of fun times. And I guess that's where the love of magic and folklore came from as well, because I think when you're in that kind of environment, you can't help but imagine the sort of creatures that might be lurking in the forests.
I definitely identify with that. The idea of walking in nature and imagining all the magic that might just be lurking behind a leafy branch or a knot in an old oak tree.
Yeah, and Somerset has incredible landscapes. You and I went on a trip to the southwest recently and we found ourselves taking a lot of back roads and narrow lanes and just really enjoying being so immersed in the countryside.
When you talked about Somerset, Martin, way back in our first series, you mentioned a lot of excellent witch stories. You told us the tale of Joan Carne, the restless witch of Sandhill, and also touched on various other witches, Mary Hunt, Jane Brooks, Elizabeth Style. There was one called Nancy as well, wasn't
there?
Yeah,
there's loads of them.
So I promised myself that I wouldn't tell a witch story. So of course I'm telling a witch story.
Yep.
But you also spoke about Taunton Castle, the Cheddar Man, and King Arthur.
I also touched on Glastonbury, which is often equated with Avalon, Arthur's kingdom. We really enjoyed our visit to Glastonbury a few years ago and came home with a great many books.
Yes, it's an extremely special place and has a folkloric origin story, which is absolutely worth telling.
Yeah.
It actually begins with Joseph of Arimathea, the man who buried Jesus, according to legend,
yeah.
and the Holy Grail, which he brought with him.
Yeah, he brought it to England.
Joseph is said to have travelled to England with the Holy Grail, and he's also actually an ancestor of King Arthur.
Of course.
King Arthur and his familial connections is going to be a rolling theme with this week's episode. So when Joseph arrived, he stuck his staff in the ground and it took root and flourished into a tree, which is now known as the Glastonbury Holy Thorn.
Now, there's a number of superstitions and traditions associated with the Holy Thorn, isn't there?
Yes, it's supposed to bloom on Christmas Day. So every year it blooms on Christmas
yeah.
Day. But this caused a bit of confusion when the calendar changed.
Oh, no.
So when the calendar changed, there were all sorts of people stood around 25th of December, waiting for the Glastonbury Thorn to flower.
Yeah.
Obviously nothing happened until old Christmas Day.
Whoa.
And then it came into bloom and they all looked silly.
Yeah.
But the thorn obviously hadn't got the memo about the calendar update. But anyone who tries to cut down the tree or indeed wish it any harm will suffer misfortune. So if you go for the tree with an axe, you might get splinters flying into your eyes, or your axe might just divert and chop your leg off instead of the tree.
Which would be a fate that would only serve them right. But what's so ghastly about the original Glastonbury thorn is it was, just a few years ago, terribly, terribly vandalised. So there's only really the stump and central trunk left. Luckily, there are lots of other surviving Glastonbury thorns scattered throughout the town.
Yes, that's right. So Joseph of Arimathea, in addition to planting his staff and growing this thorn,
yeah.
was also said to have brought the Holy Grail with him, which he hid underneath where the tower now is on Glastonbury Tor.
Yes.
And there are two springs which flow from the foot of nearby Chalice Hill. And it's said that these are mixed with some of Christ's blood that was obviously left over in the Holy Grail. The
delicious.
Springs were very popular for cures to everyday illnesses and were actually supposed to be particularly efficacious for asthma.
Oh, that's handy.
Yeah, so Holy Grail, Holy Blood of Christ, good for asthma. But people really went for this. It's recorded that in 1751, so relatively late
yeah,
for this sort of thing.
That's quite late.
10,000 people gathered on a single day to drink the waters
wow.
of this holy spring. Presumably, none of them suffered from asthma ever again.
It's so interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, Glastonbury is quite a busy, buzzy place, but not on that kind of scale
no.
today. Still, the Holy Grail, sacred springs, the magic thorn. Joseph of Arimathea made his mark on Somerset's landscape.
As you just said, the thorn did allow people to take cuttings of it.
Yes.
That was obviously okay because the intention was not bad.
No.
Because there are supposedly descendants of this holy thorn at various places throughout Somerset, including Ilminster, Chafcombe, West Buckland, and there's one at Bath
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, there's actually loads of them. And I didn't have much of a chance to talk about Bath on our last visit to Somerset, but it's a place that Eleanor and I both really like to visit. Actually, it's where we had our very first holiday together.
Yes. Yeah, it's a beautiful city with loads of really interesting history. We've got evidence of human activity in the area from the Mesolithic period, so really early.
Mm.
And by the Iron Age, there was a hill fort on Bathampton Down. Supposedly, the city, though, was founded in 863 BC by a legendary king of the Britons named Bladud.
That is so early, 863 BC. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I've not come across Bladud before.
Well, he's largely given a place in history by Geoffrey of Monmouth in their Historia Regum Britanniae.
So it's all true. Excellent. I'm expecting some kind of wild but definitely, definitely happened story.
Yes, Geoffrey of Monmouth, Martin, a totally credible source of accurate information.
Look, Eleanor, if Geoffrey of Monmouth was alive now, we'd accuse him of spreading fake news, wouldn't we?
I hear your point, but I'm choosing to ignore it in favour of a good story, which is exactly what Geoffrey would have wanted.
Mm.
So Bladud was supposedly contemporaneous with the prophet Elijah. He was the 10th ruler of Britain after the totally legitimate and definitely existed Brutus of Troy.
Yep.
And the son of, well, possibly the best named king in the history of everything?
Go on.
King Rudhud Hudibras.
Sorry, what? That's not a name. Rudhud Hudibras.
Well, it may not be making it onto anyone's list of top 10 baby names, that's for sure.
Hey, Rudhud. Hey, Rudhud. Come on,
Rudhud Hudibras.
Go and play in the garden, Rudhud Hudibras.
Bladud, and incidentally son of Rudyard Hudibras, was also the father of Lear, best known as the title character in Shakespeare's King Lear.
Okay.
So Rudyard Hudibras, I'm going to keep saying that, was his granddad. Anyway, facts. Bladud built the city of Bath and created the hot springs using magic, of course.
Oh, he just made them happen.
Yeah, just used magic.
Wow.
And he dedicated them to the goddess Sulis, who later became worshipped by the Romans as Sulis Minerva.
Which is why the city became known as Aquae Sulis, the waters of Sulis.
But the reason Bladud did all this was because he'd contracted leprosy while he'd been visiting Athens.
Uh-huh.
He was actually very well travelled, and his various sons attended university in Athens, so that was part of King Lear that Shakespeare decided to miss out.
Oh, man!
But when Bladud returned to England from Athens with his leprosy, he was imprisoned so he couldn't spread it.
Sure.
And he was the heir to the throne at this point. Rudyard was a bit worried that his son and heir was full of leprosy. But he managed to escape his imprisonment and found work as a swineherd while he figured out what he was going to do. But by observing the pigs, Bladud saw that they'd go to bathe in this particular patch of black mud and thus didn't get skin diseases like the other pigs he'd seen.
Yeah.
So he thought to himself, as he was watching the pigs, he thought he would have a go at having a bath in the black mud himself. And lo and behold, no more leprosy.
Wow.
Gone.
Oh, that simple, huh?
Yeah. So he founded Bath so that others could benefit from healing by immersion.
Oh, I see.
And created a magic spring so you didn't have to roll in the mud time you wanted to heal some sort of minor skin condition.
It's worth saying that his name is spelled Bladud, but it sounds like Bladdered, which is another slang term in Britain for being drunk.
Perhaps I should have put an emphasis differently. Yeah. Bladud.
Bladud. But anyway, Bladud, that's his name. I visited Bath a lot. I was even at school there for a bit, and I've never heard this story.
Well, perhaps surprisingly, it wasn't actually lost to history.
Really?
The story of Bladud and his cure was actually popular when Bath became a spa resort in the 18th century.
Yeah.
And there is a very old statue of the king overlooking the king's bath. And the legend was one of the marketing tactics used for the healing qualities of the water.
No, like, really?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, I must have been past this statue and just not seen it.
Yeah, so the statue's interesting. It's old, but it's actually composed of two different statues. One which was actually of Bladud and one which was of another king, which have been kind of smushed together, we think, in the 16th century, but they're older.
Right.
Because, but yeah, there's quite a lot of Bladud references around the city.
Fascinating. I mean, the baths themselves were built by the Romans, though, weren't they?
Yeah, the Romans had built the first temple structures around the hot water springs by 76 AD.
And Bath is best known for its culture as a spa town in the Georgian period. And the city is full of incredible examples of Georgian architecture today, including the Royal Crescent, the Pump Room, and the Assembly Rooms, all in gracious Bath stone. So the city has a very picturesque appearance. Its identity as a fashionable holiday destination was, of course, depicted in some of Jane Austen's novels, and she also lived there for a bit in the early 19th century.
And just think, none of it would have existed without good old King Bladud. Would you like to hear about his equally unlikely death?
Of course I would. How did Bladud die?
Well, this is mentioned as something of a side note, but he was apparently also into necromancy and just chatting to the spirits of the dead.
Mm-hmm.
Not totally sure how the two are connected, but he's supposed to have used necromancy to make a pair of wings for himself, with which he wanted to fly from the top of the Temple of Apollo in Trinovantum, otherwise known as New Troy.
Aha.
Or London.
And let me guess, he was not successful in his flight?
He was not. He was killed when he hit a wall.
Hit a wall.
Mm-hmm. Oh. So straight into a wall and died.
That's a sad end to an eventful and possibly entirely fictional life.
Now, I did notice, Martin, that you didn't mention Somerset's role in the Civil War when it was your turn.
No, that's true.
Which would ordinarily be my cue to talk in great depth about pitched battles. Mm. And indeed, the Battle of Lansdowne was fought very near Bath. But those of you who are not quite as into the works and ways of Cromwell as I am may be pleased that I've been forced to refrain in favour of our new section, County Dishes.
So, Eleanor, what are we learning to make this week?
Well, today we'll be enjoying something sweet, Somerset Easter cakes.
We're a bit late for Easter, aren't we?
We are a little bit late, but actually we're not totally sure what the connection with Easter is for these cakes.
Okay.
Other than that, they were apparently given as Easter gifts. And from the sounds of it, they do have some common flavour notes with things like hot cross buns and simnel cake. However, they have a charming backstory.
Oh, go on.
Well, after the Battle of Sedgemoor on the 6th of July, 1685, which took place near Taunton, the Duke of Monmouth was injured and fleeing. A local woman mistook him for a homeless person and kindly took him in and baked these special cakes to help him recover.
Oh.
History is unclear about how many he consumed before he felt better.
Hadn't he just been defeated in battle? Like, I don't think that's the kind of traumatic event that even stuffing your face with a load of cake can heal.
No, and he was also, of course, ultimately executed, so I suppose he didn't have to worry about his calorie intake for too long.
No, true. So, how would we make a Sedgemoor Easter cake, assuming we encounter any peaky-looking dukes we might want to assist?
Although they're called cakes, they are really a cross between a spiced shortbread biscuit, a bun, and a rock cake.
Wow.
So to be truly authentic, cassia should be used, which is cinnamon bark, but you could substitute that with any cinnamon, I think, and still get a good flavour. Essentially, blend the spices with currants, egg, flour, butter, and a generous slosh of brandy to fix that duke right up. Divide it into bun cases or mince pie pans, or just messy dollops, I think will do too, and bake till golden brown.
That sounds pretty good and quite simple, really.
Yeah, I think we could actually rustle these up for tea quite quickly.
Yum.
You can also sprinkle some sugar on top of the cakes before baking, or ice them with a sugar glaze afterwards if you want a slightly sweeter taste. As ever, we'll make the full recipe available on the blog and on our social media, so you're covered if you meet a fleeing duke. Now, I realised we could have also attempted to recreate the famous Sally Lunn bun. Oh. But of course, the recipe is a secret.
The Sally Lunn bun, for those who haven't come across one, is a large bun made of an incredibly rich dough. It's very buttery, a bit like brioche, but it's served as a kind of tea cake at Sally Lunn's tea rooms. They're absolutely delicious.
The recipe may have been brought to England and Bath in particular in 1680 by a Huguenot refugee named Solange Lyon, who anglicised her name to Sally Lunn and opened the Sally Lunn Eating House,
wow,
which is still up and running today, and nearly always has a massive queue outside its door. We certainly had to queue when we visited there.
Yeah.
But the name of the bun might also be an anglicisation of Soleil et Lune, meaning sun and moon, representing the golden crust of the bun and the white bready middle.
They are absolutely delicious. And if you're ever in Bath, you must try one. Am I also thinking that Somerset is the very county associated with King Alfred and a certain unfortunate incident involving cakes?
Yes, you are absolutely right. So supposedly, when King Alfred was on the run from the Danes, against whom things were, shall we say, not going well, he took shelter in Athelney, then an area of high land, inaccessible except by boat. He was taken in by a cowherd and his wife, with whom he lived while he regrouped his forces and gathered himself.
Yep.
One day, the cowherd's wife was baking some cakes over the fire while Alfred sat next to it and prepared his weapons. But Alfred didn't notice when the cakes started burning. Mrs. Cowherd, who thought she had been safe to trust her cakes to the king,
yep,
held him totally responsible for their burning, and quite rightly observed that he would be happy enough to eat the cakes, but couldn't be bothered to watch them.
Yeah, it's a fair assertion in my view.
Well, absolutely. But there is a plaque commemorating the event in Athelney, which says it took place in 879. And it's certainly true that Alfred built a monastery in Athelney after he'd regained his throne, presumably as an apology.
I enjoy how you seamlessly blended folklore into the county dishes segment.
Well, I wanted to include the recipe for King Alfred's bird cakes, but I reasoned they might not be very appealing. Still, I expect you'd like a little bit more folklore now.
I most certainly would. Part of my discussion with the fairy folk focused on the magic of particular places, actually, as one of my favourite features of her podcast and social accounts is her travels around the map of UK folklore.
Through Instagram and through YouTube and a little bit in the short form space, you know, you tell some stories, you do kind of educational content, But one of the things that I love most about your social media content is the way you do kind of lists of places to visit and recommendations and listicles and those kinds of things. I mean, what inspired you to go down that route?
So I think that's mainly because of my love of UK travel, and something that I like to do in my podcast is like really connect place with folklore, which I guess the Three Ravens also does, which is really, really nice to see. I think there's just something magical about connecting a story with a tangible place that you can go and visit. And I also think that there's a lot of places that are nearby to people that they might not want to visit or know that they could visit. So it's nice to go, hey, there's folk tales in other places, rather than maybe just some of the more well-known places to visit, like Cornwall or London and that sort of thing. So I like to highlight those as well.
I so agree with her about connecting stories with tangible places. I always feel that I can almost touch history when I visit these sites which have a story attached.
Yeah.
You can feel the weight of the past and the things people believed in.
And I think Fairy Folk does a wonderful job of introducing the less well-known places. So come on, Eleanor, what do we got?
Well, you talked about Glastonbury Abbey and King Arthur and the Cheddar Man when it was your turn to visit Somerset. So I thought I'd tell you about some Somerset creatures, as well as some devilish antics.
Oh, excellent.
First, it's been a while since we had a dragon on Three Ravens.
Yeah.
So I'd like to introduce you to the not very ferociously named Blue Ben.
Oh, that's an adorable name, Blue Ben.
Well, poor Blue Ben actually had a rather unfortunate time down to that pesky devil again.
What?
Blue Ben was a dragon who liked a quiet life near the water, which is something I think many of us can identify with.
Mm-hmm.
And Blue Ben supposedly lived in shale caves by the coast of Kilve, which is in West Somerset. And he liked a regular swim in the water to cool himself down after getting a bit overheated from all the breathing of fire.
Oh, that's very cute.
However, he knew he was in danger of getting stuck in the gloopy mud flats between the water and his lair. So he helped built a limestone causeway so he could safely get from his lair in the caves to his daily swim without getting stuck in the mud.
You don't tend to come across all that many builder dragons, you know? You hear about pigs overseeing the building of churches to a penny, but dragons putting causeways together, that's unusual.
It's unusual, isn't it? I think you don't think of them as builders because they've got little arms normally.
Yeah.
But maybe he had some magical method of doing it. But poor old Blue Ben was not destined to a quiet life with his causeway and his daily dips, unfortunately, because the devil had been keeping an eye on him and decided that he would make a splendid mount due to his flashy blue colour.
Aww.
So he captured Blue Ben and rode on his back until the poor dragon was exhausted and completely overheated due to flying through the fires of hell.
Oh, poor Blue Ben!
Now, the devil was having so much fun riding a dragon that he kept flying Blue Ben until the dragon was very miserable.
Aww.
When the devil did eventually get tired of flying and wandered off to do something else.
Yeah, perhaps torturing damned souls or maybe a spot of knitting.
Yes, spot of knitting. Very devilish. But Blue Ben was able to escape then anyway and tried to get back to his home. But in his hurry, he made a terrible mistake. Rather than using his lovely causeway, he went through the mud flats and got completely stuck in the mud, which sucked him under and consumed him.
Oh no, that is a surprisingly dark ending.
I'm so sorry. Oh. If it makes you feel any better, his skull was actually discovered in the 19th century when the Blue Lias shale formation near Kilve was quarried.
Wait, what? They found a dragon's skull?
Well, sort of. It's actually the fossilised skull of an ichthyosaur, which is now on display in the Wells and Mendip Museum.
Oh, right,
but it is still attributed to Blue Ben.
I love it when archaeological finds intersect with folklore. Of course, dinosaur remains must have seemed very dragon-like to the people excavating them for the first time. And we'll be talking more about that and dragons in general on this week's Three Ravens Bestiary episode.
Yes, if you can't get enough of our fire-breathing friends, there's more coming on Thursday. Now, the devil did actually seem to really like Somerset, because in addition to riding its flashy blue dragons, he got up to all sorts of other antics there.
Understandably, it's a very nice county.
It is, and the devil's actually connected with one of Somerset's megalithic monuments, the standing stones at Stanton Drew.
Ooh.
If you haven't come across Stanton Drew, it's the third largest complex of standing stones in England, and it's actually composed of three circles and a stone cove. The Great Circle, which is the biggest of them, has 26 surviving upright stones and measures 113 metres in diameter. So it's pretty big.
Wow. I've never visited it or even heard of it. That one has to go on the barrel list.
Well, surprisingly little is known or even surmised about the Stanton Drew Circles, although it's likely they date from between 2000 and 1600 BC.
Right.
But the best information we have about them is actually folk legend.
What? Folk legend? I mean, that is quite late for standing stones. Still, are you saying that the folk legend, because that's the only explanation we have, is the truth?
Well, I can neither confirm or deny that. But the story goes like this. A local couple got married on a Saturday and held the celebrations after their wedding in a field near Stanton Drew. Things progressed, as wedding parties often do, with lots of flowing drink and dancing, which became more and more enthusiastic as it became less and less coordinated.
Yeah, we've all been to one of those weddings.
We certainly have. It got so late that Saturday became Sunday, and the fiddler who was playing for the dancing stopped, put his fiddle away because he didn't want to play on the Sabbath.
Very, very wise, because there are a number of folk tales that go a little bit like this one, I think.
But this disappointed everybody, yeah. Especially the bride, who was really fond of dancing. However, all was not lost. Another fiddler soon appeared and offered to play so the party could carry on.
Yeah, I gotta say, don't like where this is going for the happy couple.
Well, the second fiddler started playing very slowly, which the bride didn't like because she'd been at the cider and she wanted to dance like a five-year-old at a birthday party. So she told him off. And so he started playing faster and faster, which all the guests thoroughly enjoyed. They danced and they danced until they started to become tired. But it was as though they were under a strange compulsion. Just couldn't stop dancing.
Because
when the bride could barely stand up, her body kept dancing.
Yeah.
And the fiddler, who was, of course, the devil himself, kept playing.
Naughty devil.
He kept on till cockcrow, when he vanished with a streak of sulphur and a scrape of violin strings, leaving all the dancers turned to stone.
Great story and a bit of a classic, but one can't help feeling that this is an allegory told to dissuade people from doing naughty and, frankly, fun things like dancing on Sundays.
Well, indeed. But either way, it is a fantastic megalithic monument. And though various theories have been put forward about the use of Stanton Drew as a ritual or ceremonial site, it definitely hasn't received as much attention as Stonehenge or Avebury, so the legend endures.
Well, that is most excellent. And as it is the best theory we currently have, it's the truth. I'm going to leave it there.
Agreed. Now, as it's my first episode back after the break, I thought I'd mark a return to form by including a bit of incredibly useful local medicine. Now, we don't talk about hemorrhoids a great deal as a society.
Oh, no, Eleanor, please. I mean, your folk remedies always seem to involve slippery, slimy things and often pinning them to bushes under the moonlight. I don't think we need that blended with hemorrhoids.
There are no slippery, slimy things in this remedy. It is surprisingly free of cruelty to mini beasts or amphibians of any sort.
I got to say, I'm still suspicious, but go on if you must. If I was looking for a cure for hemorrhoids in Somerset, what would I need to do?
Well, it's beautifully simple. All you need to do is carry a conker around in your pocket and forget about it.
What?
And it will take away the piles. That's it.
There's no catch to that, like no insects or no sticking a half-dead animal onto something else and watching it die?
Nope, that's it. Just a conker in the pocket. But it was recorded as having success as late as 1970, so...
Oh, you forgive me if I'm deeply, deeply sceptical. I don't know if I'd believe it more if I then had to carry a load of bones around in a bag.
Well, all right, Martin. Enough totally valid and scientific cures to common problems. It's story time. I'll be telling my take on the Witch of Wookiee Hole, and I'll start spinning my yarn right after this.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This happened, or maybe it did not. The time is long past, and much is now forgot. In early spring, the pages of the year turned, and two stuck together, so there was one day more than there should have been. It was a day for doing things which should not otherwise be done. It was a day for a petticoat red as battle blood to be tied around the waist of a girl called Maren Lovell, who streaked her face with the morning dew, even though it was still the frozen tears of the frost. The dew left her cheeks cold and her mouth like a frozen berry as it opened and sang a song of love. For Maren had been sewing her wedding gown, stitching it round with a golden crown like a promise ring, and she wanted a love to wear it for, to untie it and throw it to the ground to prove the hours of needle stabs had all been worth it. Though there were no leaves on the trees, and not even the pearls of blossom buds growing on their black branches, and snow still fell down the chimney at night and smothered the hope of the fire, Maren Lovell took her chilled hands and her cracked voice to the home of John the Carpenter. For the year had skipped, like a frog jumping over two lily pads, so a maid could ask a man to wed. Her face was as red as her petticoat, red as a flag of shame. He called to his brothers and they laughed, all three laughed like the back and forth of a saw slicing a beam. The carpenter laughed at her lonely love, and laughed at the feeble purse she brought, and when she said that if he refused he owed her a gift of gloves, he laughed as if he'd saw a hole in the frozen earth itself. His brothers held her there while he found an old pair of gloves that he had discarded, for they were more whole than finger and thumb, and he threw them at her. Maren Lovell took the gloves. But if she'd thought the village might have cared that John the Carpenter had defied the leap day, she could think again. She grieved and she wept, but her grief and tears might as well have been tufts of sheep's wool caught on a gatepost, or the cries of geese as they flew over the wind-whistle hills. They meant nothing at all. She sorrowed and mourned until her eyes were dry, but it was too late. For her sadness had started to turn, like milk curdles into cheese in the dairy. Marin's bad thoughts were making a strong, sharp cheese now, which she carried with her everywhere she went. She carried it through the village streets, and she carried it into the forest, and at last she carried it into the dark caves outside the village, where sunlight never shone. The caves were black as soot inside and cold as jilted love. In that time, some called the place the Valley of Grief and claimed it as the gateway to hell. It was a foolish place to go at night and a dangerous place for those who still held on to their happiness. But Maren had no happiness and she could only see the night. So she went into the caves, wearing the wedding gown for the wedding that had never happened, following the sinuous curve of the oil-dark river as it ran, leading her deeper and deeper within. At last she came to the final chamber, where there was a pool of water deeper and darker than the rest. It was a pool, but it was also a door. Maren stood at the edge of the pool, and looked into its black heart. She threw in the wedding gown. When the golden stitches touched the poisoned water, they festered and unravelled.
She threw in the lover's knot she'd made for John the Carpenter. The water tangled it into a ball of rage. She threw in her own voice, a scream of fury and mortification which echoed from the cave walls and bounced back on itself 20 times. The chorus of anger plunged below the surface of the pool and called to the black witch who slumbered in its depths. Her head had been cleaved almost in half by a king who some call great. The wound had not killed her, but it had made her weak, and she skulked below the water like a kicked dog. The black witch heard Marin's cry, and the blood from her half-split head came bubbling up and up and up. Marin Lovell saw the blood, and she reached down into its thick heat, and then she covered herself in it. The blood ran down through her brown hair. It painted her cheeks and her belly and thighs. Rusty perfume filled her nose, and clots clung underneath her nails. Red, red, red she was, where she'd been pale and sad. The blood was on her, in her, and it gave her the strength to plunge her hands down through the blood to take the clawed hands of the Black Witch. Two things the Black Witch handed to Marin Lovell. One was a knife with a black flint blade, and the other was a pearl-white orb, which was the witch's stomach stone. Every witch has a stomach stone deep within herself, which is the root of all her power. When Marin's fingers clasped around the stone, the blood of the Black Witch turned all to water and ran away, because she had given her magic away. The blood was water, and the water gone. But Marin was not Marin anymore. She was the witch. Mayday came and dressed the trees in petals bright as dancing skirts. Beneath the lengthening dusk in the meandering lanes, sweet words were whispered at stiles and garden gates. All creatures felt their hearts swell and their wings spread with the prospect of new love. The need to make pairs was never greater than at the May Day Fair. Around the ribbon-strewn pole, hearts were lost and vows were made. The apple cider flowed like a golden river, and the cheeses were as huge as cartwheels. Music from the fiddles, pipes and drums spiralled smoke-like to the sky. At the edge of the festivities, the witch watched. Shadows fell where she looked. Despite the laughter and the flow of drink, a blast of cold air wreathed around the maypole. Where love had skipped between the shining eyes of couples, now poison made an extra dancing partner. The witch's curse was on them all now, and it fell most of all on John the Carpenter. As he tried to make his drunken way across the village, a cart bearing the largest and heaviest cheeses broke free of its moorings and crushed him under its weight. The witch clutched the white orb of power, and she didn't look back as his legs were broken under the rolling wheels. One such couple who had been in love and had been overlooked as they danced was Beth and Barnard. Beth made Barnard beautiful with her love. He glowed with it like a star because she had chosen him. He'd never seen such a thing as a jewel, but her love made him just as precious. There was no point to Barnard's existence unless it was loving Beth. After May Day, it was different. Beth was cold and cruel. She laughed at Barnard, and he could tell that she was sneering instead of joining in his humour. She criticised his clothes, the unevenness of his teeth, the smell of him after a day of labouring. One day, Barnard went by the gate to Beth's garden and saw her with his best friend Matthew. Matthew had an early crop of strawberries with him, and Beth was eating them from his fingers. Her glass blue eyes met Barnard's, and though she knew he had seen, she carried on doing it anyway. She licked the juice running down the back of Matthew's hand. Her tongue was as red as fruit. Barnard's stomach writhed as though he's eaten biting serpents. He looked into the river and thought about the heady rush of water. He looked over the edges of the gorge and thought about the smash of bone. He looked up into the clear blue sky and he saw a dove. The dove seemed to spread its wings and fill Barnard with an extraordinary sense of peace. Its flight guided him to Glastonbury, where he said his vows in a shrine of blue and white and gold, kissed the feet of Christ, and left all worldly cares behind. As for the witch, she never lifted her curse from the young couples of the village, so never a happy marriage was made. The young folk tried to follow the customs of life and stitched wedding gowns even if they were bathed with tears and went through the pretense of it all, even though there were more arguments than sweet words and more blows than kisses. Satisfied with her work, the witch left the village and went into the caves of Wookie Hole, where the black witch had taken her hands. She made her home there in the dark. Darkness only makes more darkness. With no light, it's hard to tell the difference between sun and shadow. For the witch, everything was shadow. Her rage was a book which was difficult to close now that it had been opened, and every page was a different malicious story. One story told of wheat fields turned to blazing fires. Another told of orchards stinking with rot. Calves were born with two heads, and nightingales flew backwards. Newborn babies spoke in foul tongues, and hens' eggs hatched into sulphurous ooze. Couples at their weddings trying to speak their vows found that every word came out backwards, and the pipe organ wheezed tuneless music for corpses to dance lurchingly down the aisle at their own funerals. The people of Wookie were too frightened to approach the caves, and the witch never left them. But it was said that each day she used the Black Witch's pool like a mirror to see all over the village and decide where she would strike next. At last, they wrote to the Abbot of Glastonbury of the many terrible twists and turns of the witch's story of revenge. During this time, Barnard, who the witch's curse had sent into the arms of God, had become cold and pure and bright in his faith. He was bright, like a knife. He was Father Barnard now, and a priest of repute. All the love he'd given to Beth had been signed over to God. When the abbot gave him the commission to go to Wookie Hole and destroy the witch, Barnard was a blade which had been sharpened long ago. Two things the abbot handed to Barnard. One was an ancient crucifix which had been stolen by pagan raiders and buried in the earth until a monk of the true faith had unearthed it. It knew the secrets of the Barrow Kings as well as those of the saints and martyrs. The other was a chalice of finest silver, burnished like a shield. He prayed as he travelled to the caves of Wookie Hole, to that place the ancient songs call the Valley of Grief. By the time that he arrived, his faith was so strong within him that it was like an extra cloak around him, almost visible in blue and white and gold. The witch came to the entrance of the cave to watch his approach. His crucifix and chalice were mirrored in her dagger and orb, one held in either hand. While Father Barnard glowed bright, the witch was limned in glittering black light, her forearms streaked with the dark blood of the Black Witch. When he held the crucifix out towards her, she countered it with her dagger, turned hilt down and blade pointing up. The force between those two weapons met and clashed as though two great beasts tore at each other tooth and claw. Then the witch tore the dagger away and ran from Father Barnard through the caves. In the half-light, she had no advantage, but the darkness of her realm could defeat this priest. Father Barnard followed after. He prayed and sang, and then he stooped to the running water of the River Axe, which ran through the first chamber of the cave. He gathered the water and the chalice burnished like a shield, and he prayed over it. He prayed in the name of the Father who had borne all the children of the world, the Son who had suffered for their wickedness, and the Spirit which had moved the souls of the faithful. The river water turned over in the chalice and glowed until it shone like an opal with many colours. Barnard was silent. He listened. There was no breath. There was no rustling. There was no life. So he dipped his fingers into the silver water in the chalice, the holy water which had been blessed, and scattered it on the cave floor in front of him in an arc of shining droplets. Where the droplets fell, they illuminated the slender, ghostly footprints of the witch and showed the way that she had gone. Quiet as a panther stalks its prey, he followed in their wake. Quiet as a heron takes a fish, he scattered holy water. And he placed his own feet in the footsteps of the witch until he came to a small, enclosed cave where there were no more footprints. He heard no breath. He heard no rustling. He heard no life. But he knew that she was there, in the dark. Barnard flung the holy water from the chalice forward with the flawless aim of perfect faith. The witch's scream, as brilliant silver flame engulfed her, echoed from the cave walls and bounced back on itself twice 100 times. The light was so bright that Barnard could perfectly see what was happening to her. Skin and hair melted from muscle and bone, revealing hard grey rock below. Everything which had still been human about Marin Lovell burned away, and what remained was shrouded up in silent stone. The dagger and the stomach stone of the Black Witch dropped useless to the ground as the Witch of Wookiee Hole became nothing more than a lump of rock. Barnard left the caves and he didn't look back as the witch stayed to bear witness to the long centuries. But many others came to look, and they come still. And you may look too, if you make your way into the caves today. This happened. Or maybe it did not. The time is long past, and much is now forgot. So, Martin, what did you think of the Witch of Wookiee Hole?
Well, I'm glad that people in Somerset have better luck in love now.
Yes, she's finished.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite a reaction, isn't it, to being jilted?
It is. I mean, I think undertaking such a career of evil.
Yeah.
Is also, it's like reaction.
A full-on legit Raiders of the Lost Ark melting away in the end.
Yeah.
Wow. Anyway, it was great. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Not a great deal is actually known about the story or if it had any basis in historical fact. Mm. But there are some pretty interesting details about it. For example, you can visit the caves today and walk through the various chambers, some of which are fancifully labelled the witch's kitchen, which is, you know, back room, etc.
Yeah.
But you can actually see the piece of petrified stone, which is supposed to be how the poor witch ended up.
You say the poor witch, but do you think we're really meant to feel sorry for her based on your story?
I do a little bit. I think she carried things too far.
She got carried away, yeah.
I don't know. I always try and find an angle in a story with a villain whereby there's a good reason for the villainy.
Yeah.
Interestingly, though, there is some slightly conflicting information about the witch's remains. Although the witch-shaped stone, complete with pointy nose, is very visible in the caves of Wookiee Hole, there's also a skeleton at Wells Museum, home of Blue Ben the Dragon, which was found in one of the chambers, and that's also billed as belonging to the Witch of Wookiee Hole. And, you know, while her mortal remains can't be in two places, presumably, it certainly is the ancient skeleton of a woman, and it was found with two objects, a dagger and a white alabaster orb.
So I had to include those in my story.
That's so fascinating and tantalizing. Now, does anyone have any idea what the orb might have actually been used for?
Absolutely none. So my imagination was free to run wild.
Hence the stomach stone, yes. I guess. I was curious about the Black Witch in the Valley of Grief in your story. Where does that idea come from? Like, is that usually in the legend of the Witch of Wookiee Hole?
Actually, no, it's not. Mm. It is taken from a very short section in the Mabinogion in which King Arthur and his men try to defeat this character called the Very Black Witch, who's described as living in the Valley of Grief.
Wow.
And this location has been quite difficult to pinpoint, but some scholars who must just have the best job in the world figuring out where stuff in the totally fictional Mabinogion is, have suggested that the area may be in Somerset around Wookiee Hole.
Okay.
So I just took that idea and ran with it.
Fascinating. I also like how you brought in ideas about Leap Day after we discussed it on our special episode fairly recently. And May Day, of course, it felt like a very seasonal story. Anyway, thank you so much, Eleanor. I thoroughly enjoyed that, even if it was another witch story. I noticed, though, that there were no dogs, which I think demonstrates personal growth.
I did actually write a misfortune for a dog in the village, but I deleted it.
Whoa, look at you.
Yeah, it wasn't necessary. And actually, it was quite unpleasant, and I do really like dogs, so I took it out.
Sure.
Should we talk correspondence?
Let's. Should we start with some comments from Spotify?
Yes, so St. Sugal on last week's Suffolk episode. Great to have the county episodes back. I love learning about English folklore and the myths and legends of England. Please, please, never stop.
Thank you very much, Sugal. We won't. We also heard from Lissa, who's churning the back catalogue, who said about your Worcestershire episode, Eleanor, I love this sweet story. It reminds me of the Grimm's tale, Bearskin. The hero breaks his ring in half and gives it to the girl who's agreed to marry him when his time serving the devil is up. Alas, no new reviews this week on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, but please, if you have 5 minutes, do drop some stars or give us a thumbs up wherever you listen, as it really does help other people to find the podcast.
Also, if you write us a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, we will read it out on the next episode, and I promise I won't lose a silly voice. So please do write a review. We really like to hear from you.
And in terms of hearing from people, we have had some lovely messages this week, including from Donna, Viv, Trudy and Alicia, who were very happy to have us back for series 4, and from Mark, who was in touch about mandrake roots.
This was in response to a post Martin made about mandrake roots on Facebook, to which Mark replied, I've read that German alchemists in the Middle Ages believed that the mandrake root grew in the ground at the foot of the gallows. This was because it grew from the emanations of men released when their necks were broken at the moment they were hanged.
Yep, so gross, but so interesting.
This is great. Mark continues, this and the belief that witches who messed about with mandrake roots gave birth to the idea of soulless babies, the homunculi that Martin mentioned in his post.
Yeah.
These ideas were the starting point for Hans Heinz Ewer's 1911 science fiction novel, Auron, which has been filmed several times. My favourite one is the 1928 silent version with Brigitte Helm of Metropolis fame. They just missed out on the sound revolution, so a year later they did it all again as a talkie, but I didn't think it worked as well.
Absolutely fascinating, Mark, and I've never heard of Auron, so now I absolutely have to check that out.
Mm-hmm.
We also heard from Tony in response to your Magic and Medicines episode on crystals from last Thursday, and he said, really interesting, thanks. I have to admit, I'm not a believer when it comes to crystals and healing / mystical properties, but it's always fascinating to hear folk beliefs on the matter. On a side note, I listened to the episode this morning while looking through the data from a 3rd to 5th century Romano-British farmstead I'm working on. It's worth saying Tony is an archaeologist. And he continues, with evidence of at least 6 herbs with medicinal values in the assemblage, as well as artifacts including a stone mixing pallet and a copper probe or scoop. Looking into Roman medicinal practices, it looks like copper alloys were usually used for instruments. A lot put it down to iron being a religious taboo for medical instruments, but I do wonder if it was more basic, with iron items potentially causing tetanus.
That is
super duper interesting, Tony, because iron, of course, is famously viewed as a means of magical defence in English folklore. So it was quite normal to pour molten iron in front of your doors hang iron items over windows and other entries. And it's also part of the process of hanging up lucky horseshoes, not least at the mouth of chimneys.
Well, yeah, of course. If you go to most really old English houses, you find evidence of witch marks too. So little engravings, often circular flowers, as well as other glyphs around fireplaces and on door lintels to protect against witches and other bad spirits.
Understandably so. The last thing anyone needs is a witch coming down the chimney.
Yeah, particularly if you've reached a really good bit in the latest episode of your new favourite TV show. Come on, Fanny No Teeth, get ye gone. They were about to start kissing.
Speaking of Fanny No Teeth,
yes,
we had some lovely responses to Martin's story from last week's episode, including from Enya, who said she cackled loudly about a rat rumoured to be named Terry.
Yes.
Janie, who said she spat a tea out at the introduction of Fanny No Teeth. Me too, Janie, me too. And Reese, who said it was one of his favourite Three Ravens stories so far.
Well, thank you all very, very much. I'm so glad you enjoyed it. And next week's story is also going to be silly, for as members of our lovely Patreon community will know from my previous Patreon exclusive King Arthur stories, when it comes to King Arthur, I think the only way to go is silly. And next week, I'm doing my take on the Sword in the Stone.
I'm pretty excited. Martin, prepare to spend a long time editing out my giggling from the episode recording. I cannot deal with your King Arthur stories.
I am ready and waiting.
Meanwhile, we've also had some lovely interactions on X, including from Lucy Holland herself, author of this month's Three Ravens book club pick, Song of the Huntress, who thinks it's extremely cool that we're reading her novel. She said she's honoured.
Which is very nice indeed. Thank you, Lucy.
Then, last, as ever, we've had some lovely things happening on the Three Ravens podcast group on Facebook, including some super witchy art from Ruth, some pictures of stunning handmade brooms and besoms from Emily.
Oh my goodness, they're so cool. Awesome work, Emily. Just wow.
Plus, Corbred also posted some fascinating folklore behind the legend of the Dragon of Wantley.
Now, this was prompted by Three Ravens stalwart Sabrina posting about a new opera being performed locally in Sussex, which we also attended on Friday night, based on this legend.
So Corbred said, Warncliffe Chase is an area of wild upland above the southern end of Warncliffe Crags, north of Sheffield. Over 2,000 quern stones have been found along the crags, wow, dating back to the Iron Age. The Wortley family have had a home on the site of Wortley Hall, probably since Norman times. The tale of the Dragon of Wantley tells how a dragon, living in a cave in the crags — there is still a cave there known as Dragon's Den near Warncliffe Lodge — terrorised the locals by preying upon their children and cattle. A knight, Moor of Moor Hall, takes on the dragon in battle, wearing a suit of spiked armour, waiting in a pond for the dragon to come and drink. Moor kills the dragon, either, depending on which version you read, with a blow or by allowing the dragon to coil around him and squeeze, thus impaling itself on his spikes.
Super duper interesting. Thanks, Corbred. And Eleanor's just read an excerpt there, so if you hop on the Three Ravens podcast group, there's more detail on the original post.
So, one thing I find interesting about that story is it has definite links to other worm and dragon stories from around that neck of the woods, including the story you told on our County Durham episode in series one, Martin, the Sockburn Worm.
Yeah, you have the Sockburn Worm, the Laidley Worm, the Linton Worm, loads of these stories from across the north of England and Scottish borders, as you've been discovering doing your research for the next County Durham episode.
It seems to be worm country up there, which is why I live in the south of England.
Still, fascinating stuff. And Corbred, thank you. Keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, everyone. We love hearing from you, so do please stay in touch with us, either on social media via the usual channels, facebook.com/3ravenspodcast, Instagram at 3ravenspodcast, or X at 3ravenspod, or send us an email at 3ravenspodcast@gmail.com.
And if you can't get enough of social media, do join the lovely 3Ravens podcast group on Facebook, where you can connect with other listeners and post your own delightful things. And of course, on Fridays, I've been running the Folky Friday hashtag on Twitter, celebrating different aspects of folklore. This week, our theme will be nature gods and summer spirits.
Oh, that's going to be a good one. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to seeing what people post for that. And we mentioned this in our last episode, but as I just said, we are starting a brand new Three Ravens book club, and our first pick is Song of the Huntress by Lucy Holland, which I haven't started yet, but I can't wait to get stuck into.
I have.
So if you're looking for a new read and fancy meeting some like-minded people to have a book-related chat, See if your local library can lend you a copy.
If you enjoy films, you can also access episodes of the Three Ravens Film Club on our Patreon, which is at patreon.com/3ravenspodcast. Last week, we released an episode all about the 2022 folk horror movie Men, and we're very excited as next month we are going to be watching and discussing the seminal folk horror film The Wicker Man, an enduring classic.
But before that, we will be back on Thursday with our first bestiary episode of the new series, in which Martin will be talking all about dragons. Yep. And then the full local legends episode with the fairy folk comes out on Saturday.
And as for next week's episode, I've got a mountain of folklore to mine my way through, because we're going back to Cornwall.
Oh, I can't wait. There's so much amazing stuff to talk about in Cornwall. Until then, while our story's gone that way, we'll go this way.
And remember, don't whistle until you're out of the woods.
Thanks and credit go to The Folklore of Somerset by Kingsley Palmer, Somerset Curiosities by Enid Byford, The Hellebore Guide to Occult Britain, and of course, The Fairy Folk. Our theme song is the traditional folk ballad Three Ravens, performed by Eleanor Conlon and Ben Harbour, and our logo is by Ollie James Dare.
The Three Ravens podcast is a Rust and Stardust production, produced by me, Martin Vaulks. Thanks for listening.
God send every gentleman such hounds, such hawks, such leemen, with a down, derry, 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 down, down.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.